Then he immediately launches into, and if it's by grace, it's not by works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. Now, this phrase, otherwise grace is no more grace. No, take it back. This phrase, otherwise work is no more work. I don't believe that has textual support in the... Yeah, you see, this is verse 6, and it says, now, if by grace, no longer out of works, otherwise the grace is no longer become grace. And that's the end of the text as far as the later manuscripts have it. The TR, which is behind the King James, does have the other phrase, and if by works, no longer by grace, because work is not work unless... You can't argue that it's by works unless that's what causes it. So there's an expansion in the TR, the Textus Receptus, but his real issue is here, that this is an election of grace. So we're right back to where we were back there in chapter 9, if you'll remember. Because back there in chapter 9, he said, the children not being yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works. So we're still dealing with this election thing, and it's interesting to me that in our studies of both chapter 9 and chapter 11, when Paul has returned to the critical issue of the dependability of the words of God, invariably, in both cases, his argument eventually ended up in the area of this doctrine of election. And in chapter 9, verse 11, he said it was the purpose of God, and then he summoned this defining standard, election. That's, for you Greek students, kata plus the accusative. It's according to the standard of this thing called election. And in chapter 11, he declares the same defining standard, but he adds that it's an election of grace. So this makes our understanding of the concept pretty important because it's so close to the bottom of the pile of those fundamental plan issues. Now, we've argued many times that this is really not an illogical concept at all, because everybody knows that a plan to be executed requires an enormous number of details that have to work in order for the plan to come to fruition. And those number of details when it comes to the plan of God, many of them are actually recorded in terms of prophetic utterances, so we're told ahead of time what God is going to do. Those are the details. And of course, as soon as a thing is uttered as a prophecy, that brings up the issue of whether God means what he says and whether he will adhere to what he said, because that's the whole question of whether God's word can be trusted. So once a prophecy is uttered, it either has to come to pass or it has to fall. And if it falls, that proves that we haven't heard from God at all, or that our concept of him as a truth teller is fruitless. In any case, both of those just blow our hope completely out of the water. So when we talk about the issue of election, this is not out of the ballpark at all, because the real issue of election is making sure that the details are there so that they can come to pass the way the plan requires it. Now, we've used the term slopping the gears over the years, and what that means is that in the wisdom and omniscience of God, there are various ways that any number of different kinds of details can end up with the same result. So God doesn't have to control all the details in order for the plan to come together, but he has to control certain elements of them. We used the illustration of the way gears mesh in the back end of a vehicle. It used to be the rear end of a truck or car or whatever, because it used to be all rear wheel drive. Now I have to change my whole illustration. But anyway, the way the gears meshed would determine whether they meshed or not, would determine whether the car could actually go down the road. But as long as you had any level of meshing, you could get the axle to turn and the car would move. But in the engineering of those gears meshing and stuff, if you didn't have them meshing exactly like they should, they would create vibration and noise, and you'd hear this roaring sound in the back end of the thing as you drove it, but you were still going down the road. That's slopping the gears. It was kind of destructive to the gears themselves because it's a harmonic vibration thing that sets up, and that's hard on them, and then the gears might actually fatigue and break, and then you won't be going down the road anymore because it's no longer slopping the gears. There are no gears there. Now, I bring that up simply because the issue of details in relation to the plan is a logical necessity and a biblical declaration, but which of the details, those are often left out in the undeclared, you know, God knows, but we don't. But when it comes to the issue of election, this is a pretty critical issue of detail. So this is where we're going to be doing our thinking this evening, because he deals with this issue of reserving to himself. And he calls that reserving to myself a remnant according to election. And then he introduces this issue of grace in the process. And then he actually says down here, the conclusion that you have to draw is that Israel, that is the big Israel, has not obtained that which he seeks, but the remnant according to the election have, and the rest are blind. So we're working in some areas that I freely and fully realize are not popular doctrinally. This is a very difficult area for many people in their thinking. So we're going to give it another run this evening. One of the things that I want to deal with is this opening phrase here in verse 5. This is really not a full translation of the text because there is another word that the King James just basically omits, and that's the word chi. But we would translate this, even so, also then, or even so, therefore, also, or in the same manner, therefore, also, or something along that line. Because there's a word that is translated even so, and then there's the word that's translated then. That's the therefore, the un in the Greek. And then there's another one that's not translated here, but it's the chi, which in this case would be also. Now, what that means is these four words are referring back to this Elijah thing. And this is important for us. When Paul called the account of Elijah into play for his argument here, he was raising one of the first problematical issues regarding whether you can trust God or not. Because what he's dealing with is the level of God's participation in his plan, and to what degree he will go to make sure that the things that he has said are dependable and trustworthy. So one of the issues of Elijah's setting is whether that was unique to Elijah's situation or whether that's a constant that runs through history. And that's really not a small issue for people in respect to their participation with God. Really, there's little objection from most men to a doctrine of God's choosing that is only enforced occasionally. I mean, most people will say, well, God, like everybody else, is entitled to some choices that are enforceable. They wouldn't have any problem with God bringing Saul of Tarsus to his knees, blinding him, making the revelation of Jesus' identity to him so profoundly powerful that he had no real options after that to yield to the conviction that was there. They wouldn't have any problem with God doing that if that was necessary for his plan, as long as you don't insist that that's the norm. It's just one of the ways God makes sure he gets his thing done. Occasionally there are special people that he just zaps and they're elected. And there are a lot of people who don't have any problem with that as long as it's just an occasional thing. But the objections start to getting fairly serious if that concept of God making the choice and enforcing it puts men entirely subject to God's choices. That's when the objections start to come up. So the first thing that we have to understand is that this is a hot button issue, and Paul knew that and addressed it all the way back there in chapter 9. It was in chapter 9 that we ran across this issue of God saying that the issue of His purpose according to election was going to be, I will have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion, so that it's not of him that wills, nor of him that runs, but of God that shows mercy. So here we have just a point-blank statement that God says, look, this is my right. That doesn't make it easier for people to swallow, but it's nonetheless there. So when we come to this passage in chapter 11, and he starts dealing again with the issue of the election of grace, we're still dealing with the same thing. Whether or not this election is particular. Now, historically, what has happened theologically in the hearts and minds of men, and you can trace this historically through church history, that men have rejected a particular election on God's part on the basis of two different doctrinal arguments. One of them is a very minor position. What I mean by minor is that not a lot of people will go here, but there are some who have. And in recent days, some fairly big name evangelical theologians have gone this route, and that's the route of arguing that the love of God is so profoundly powerful and potent, and His mercy is without understanding, it's so broad, that really there's nobody that's not going to be saved. That's called universalism, and the argument is even Satan is going to finally end up in heaven. The reason that that's a minority theological position is that if you're going to be a Christian theologian, the Bible has to have some place in your argument, and that is so contrary to biblical revelation that it just won't fly. I mean, there are just too many places in the scriptures where the reality of lost people being lost without redemption, without resource, without, you know, you can't get there. The Bible is so full of that, and even the final picture of Satan being cast into the lake of fire and all of his demons and a whole bunch of people standing before the throne of God in heaven being cast into the lake of fire. Those images are all rendered null and void by a doctrine of universal salvation. So that's the reason most people just don't go there. It's unsupportable. If you have any confidence in the Bible, and of course this is the issue, is the Word of God rendered of none effect? Should we pay attention to what it says or not? However, there is a majority way that has actually dominated visible Christendom pretty much, and that is the subjection of divine election to human election. The argument runs something like this. God looked down the quarters of time and saw who would choose them, so He chose them. And that's a very appealing, perhaps, doctrine, but it does subject the choice of God to the choice of men. And, of course, the question then is, if God's choices are subject to man's choices, how can you trust anything He says, given the fact that men's choices are notoriously pathetic? So, we find that the subjection of God's choice to human choice immediately compromises the gospel. Immediately. Because as soon as you subject the choice of God to the choice of man, then you have to say, okay, what choice do men have to make in order for God to make His choice so that their lives will be okay forever? And immediately you'll run into, well, you got to be baptized. Or God will look at your choice and say, that wasn't a valid choice, and so I'm not going to choose you. Or you got to, you know, you can't ever sin too badly after you've made your choice, because if you do, God will release you from His choice, and you will be cast into the fire or whatever. There are all kinds of things, and there are all these theologies that float on the basis of the subjection of God's choice to man. But the root of the gospel that Paul taught in Romans was outlined very clearly in chapter 4 of the book, where he asked, what did Abraham discover? And the conclusion of Romans 4 is that Abraham discovered that the one who makes the promise is the one who's obliged to keep it. That was his faith. So that when he promised Abraham and Sarah a son, it was up to him to produce it. You can't make a promise and then hinge it on somebody else and say, well, if they do what they're supposed to, it'll work out, and if they don't, well, it won't. Abraham learned after 100 years, and no telling how many years of personal struggle over the issue, that if God made the promise, it's up to him to keep it. Well, that's the issue of the integrity of the word. If God says something, it's up to him to make sure it happens. So the fundamental root of the gospel is that it's up to God to fulfill his words. And all of the variations of the subjection of God's promises to man's responses are basically denials of that root. If God's promise is dependent on what I do with it, then his promise isn't very secure. Because what if I don't do what I should with it? Then the promise goes down the drain. So, given that background, what we have here in these four words of verse 5, even so then also at this present time, that's another phrase. Oh, there's the also. Huh. They just moved it. Okay. Nothing like confusing the teacher. The issue is that the Elijah event is being called by Paul the typical or the standard. He even uses that terminology when he says kata plus the accusative with according to the election. This is the standard. What is the standard? Well, the Elijah experience. What is that? I have reserved for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed to Baal. That's the standard. Now, the question that we have here is huge, because the even so, this word translated even so means in the same manner, in the same way. And that means whatever method that God used back then, he's going to use again. That's what in the same manner means. It's the same method. That means that the even so deals primarily with the way things are done. And that means we're dealing with a methodological issue rather than some kind of conceptual or theological one. And there's a pretty fair distinction in the scripture between purposes and methods. We've always said that agape identifies the objectives, that's the purpose. And pistis, which is the word for faith, defines the methodology. So God tells you what's important, and then he tells you how you can be involved in that. And the one is love, and the other is faith. You trust him, and you're plugged into what's important. Those are issues of purpose and means. And this even so is bringing up the means or the method issue. Now, I want us to think a little bit about that, because what he's actually saying is that the same method that was used in Elijah's situation is in play now. And that's a big claim. We even have the therefore, which means we're drawing a conclusion from the Elijah event. And also means there's a continuum from the past to the present. But that means that God is arguing for a constancy of action on God's part that spans history. And we studied about 2 or 3 weeks ago that one of the big problems that people have with trusting God is that his ways of doing things are not always the same. So here we have Paul saying, this way is the same, while admitting that some of the other things are not. Well, then you have to say to Paul, well, how do you know this one's the same if these others are not? I mean, we argued 2 or 3 weeks ago that one of the biggest problems with faith in Jesus as the Christ was that when he came, he didn't act the way they thought he should, given the focus on Israel And then when the church began to be a reality and the gospel went into the regions of the Gentiles, and Israel was attacked and destroyed in 70 AD by Rome and all of that, this created a huge tension in terms of, well, what in the world? How can we trust God who made all these commitments to Israel, and now he's not even honoring them? He's over here doing something else. So there are times when God's actions do change, and there are times when they don't. And what Paul is saying right here in verse 5 is that in this case, the methodology stays the same all the time. Now, I want you to think with me about that in relation to the way that some of these constancy things are argued. I know that all of you are familiar with the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. And one of their favorite texts is Hebrews 13:8. You know what it says? Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. And they take off with that and say, okay, now if Jesus ever did it, he'll always do it. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if he healed a woman with an issue of blood back then, if you have that problem, he'll heal you too. If he cleansed the leper back then, and you have leprosy, he'll cleanse you. If he healed people of diseases back then, whatever disease you have, he'll do it today for you too. If he made people like Abraham and Solomon and David filthy rich, if you trust him, he'll make you rich too. Because he's the same, yesterday, today, and forever. And they go on and on. I mean, this sermon is going to last for 45 minutes or so. Just before they ask you to send your money to them so that God can fulfill his promise to them to make them wealthy at your expense. How about, of course, they promise that if you do that, somebody else, I mean, you know, the divine thing will kick in and he'll make you wealthy for making me wealthy and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, we all know who gets wealthy over that. It's the guy on TV. He's always the one that's the wealthy one. Everybody that sends their money, you never get to talk to them about how wealthy they got. Well, how do you deal with that? If Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, how come he doesn't do things the same way? Well, part of the answer is pretty obvious. Being the same is an essence or character issue. Doing the same has little to do with that. This is a detail of the plan issue. It does not come out of the character, except as the plan comes out of the character. So that Jesus can be the same yesterday, today, and forever without doing the same things yesterday, today, and forever. For example, the plan is rooted in the love of God. That's God's essence and character. The plan has to do with certain things that this love required, because the plan required it. And one of those issues was identifying Jesus as the Christ. This was a part of the necessity of the manifestation of the love, because the love isn't going to do anybody any good if they don't come to faith in Jesus as the Christ, because without faith it won't affect them properly. So in the plan, there had to be a way to make it clear that Jesus was the Christ. And in the Gospels, we find out that the way that that was made clear was on two levels of power. Physical, which had to do with the healings and all that, and spiritual, which had to do with the demons and all of that. So, in the realms of the physical and spiritual, the issue of power was what identified Jesus as the Christ. Once he's identified as the Christ, the plan moves on. Then what about the demonstrations that he's the Christ? Well, they can be abandoned because the issue's been set. It's kind of like, how do you get, I don't know if you recognize this or not, but this is the Middle East. This is Egypt over here, and this is the Dead Sea, and this is the Sea of Galilee, and this is Jerusalem and all that. Okay, Israel went down here during the days of Jacob's old age, and they became a nation. The question then arose, one day, how are we going to get these people across the Red Sea into this area so that they can go up here and take this land? Well, there were any number of ways that that could be done, but the method that God chose to do it with was he had Moses hold his rod up, and the sea parted and backed up and backed up and backed up and backed up until it was backed up far enough for several million people to just run across on dry ground. And the water had stacked up as it backed up so high that when Pharaoh and his army tried to chase them, Moses let the water come back, and when it did, it drowned them all. Well, that was just a detail of the plan. How do you do this? Well, this is how we're going to do it. Now, does every time Israel need to cross a creek or whatever, does the water need to back up all this? Well, it did at the River Jordan again. But from then on, that methodology was set aside. We don't ever read about it happening again after the crossing of the Jordan. So that's the same kind of thing. Once the plan has affected its result, then the method that brought it about can be set aside. And that's the reason why Jesus doesn't do the same thing day, yesterday, today, and forever. Because the details of the plan require certain actions at certain times, and they don't require them afterwards. So now, I brought that up because I want you to be aware that when Paul said in Romans 11 that you could go to Elijah's experience and say, that was the typical norm. That's the way God's always going to do it. In order for his plan to work, he is going to reserve for himself. That's what he says when he says, even so, therefore, also at this present time, there is this same thing called the remnant, just like there was back then. How can Paul say that? How does he know that it's a standard that doesn't ever change, that this is one method that God never sets aside? How can he do that? What decides whether something is the same forever in terms of method or whether the methods will change? What determines that? When can a person argue that the method has not changed? I mean, the prosperity preachers, they would like to take me out and string me up by my ankles, you know, because I'm contradicting their pet money-raising schemes. And they would do that on the basis of, you have no business telling these people that Jesus doesn't do the same thing today that he did back then. You have no business. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Their bottom line is what's being affected, though. I mean, that's the reason they don't want me to say what I said. But the question is, how do you do that? Well, let me see if I can explain it. Method issues are determined by two things: plan issues, the big plan, and the condition issues. If the plan's the same and the condition's the same, then the method's going to have to stay the same. But if the plan has some details in it and the conditions in those details shift, then you're going to use a different method. God didn't drown all the Canaanites in the Jordan by backing up the water and sucking them in there and then closing it on them. That's how he got rid of Pharaoh and his army. Why didn't he just, I mean, that would have solved a lot of the problems going into the land. Oh, we wouldn't have had to fight. We wouldn't have had to, you know, we could have just gone in there and taken over if God had just suckered those people into the Jordan and then let the water close on them. Well, what I'm trying to say is plan and condition issues determine the method. Now, in order to tell whether the method's going to be the same or whether there's going to be a difference, has to do with being able to identify the plan and the conditions that are directly affecting it. Now, in the Elijah situation, the plan was this. God was going to preserve a group of human beings who would be faithful to him in the face of enormous pressure towards apostasy.
There were 900 false prophets, and there was one legitimate one. And the pressure to conform in the nation to the worship of Baal was enormous. It came from the throne down. And when you have everybody all around you, from the throne down to your next door neighbors, everybody telling you that you need to worship Baal, the pressure to apostatize from, turn away from Yahweh and go to worshiping Baal is enormous, especially when it gets to be a life and death thing. They killed his prophets. They tore down his altar. It's deadly. It's kind of like living in Islamic country and not being a Muslim. You can actually be put to death for refusing to convert. It's a deadly thing. We're real laid back in the U.S. because of our background in democracy and all that, where we think that freedom of religion is the birthright of every individual and they can worship any God they want to and all that kind of thing. I mean, that's been instilled in us from the get-go. So we're pretty laid back. If our neighbor's Jehovah's Witness, don't bother us, as long as they don't bother us. If they're Mormons, hey, as long as they don't keep bringing their Mormon doctrine over to your house. If they're Indian Sikhs, so. I mean, we don't get out our guns and go around trying to get rid of everybody that's not a born-again Christian. You're a Christian? No. You're an apostate. You deserve to die. And because of that, in Elijah's day, there was this huge pressure to become an apostate. And the question is, what conditions caused that? The plan was to preserve a faithful group of people in the worship of God. The condition was pressure from without and within. Because people don't start worshiping a God just to do it. There's always something inside of them that makes that God appealing to them. And then there's some things outside of them that also makes it appealing. So this pressure was without and within. Now I want you to hold that thought and go with me back to chapter 9 again. And look at what Paul said in, about verse 29 or so. It says here that Isaiah cried concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant will be saved. He will finish his work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will, because of short work will the Lord make upon the earth. And as Isaiah said, unless the Lord of Sabaoth had left us the seed, we would have been as Sodom and been made like unto Gomorrah. Now what does that mean? If he hadn't left us a remnant, we would have become like Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, what did Sodom and Gomorrah become like? Well, it depends, doesn't it, on at what point? At the final point, Sodom and Gomorrah were ash heap because of the fire and brimstone that fell out of heaven and destroyed the cities. It covered them with hot, molten, you know, ash. They were destroyed by fire from heaven. And he says, if God hadn't kept us a remnant, we would have become like that. But why did they become like that? Why did this fire fall out of heaven? Because of their ungodliness. So the real issue is not the fire from heaven. It's the character. And he says, if God hadn't have left us the seed, our character, being like that of the Sodomites and the Gomorrahites, would have driven us to the same conclusion. Unless he had done something, we would have become like that. So this is the whole issue. When we're talking about the reason why God has to do what he has to do, why were there 7,000 men in Israel that had not bowed their knees to Baal? Was it because they were especially godly? Were they just more intelligent than everybody else in the country? Did they understand and operate on the basis of some kind of moral righteousness within them that kept them from being subject to the pressures of apostasy? Were they inherently good so that all these things came out of them? Or when God said, I've reserved to myself 7,000 men, was he saying, look, I've had to do some things. I've had to address some 7,000 of these people in order to keep them from bowing the knee to Baal. And what was it that God had to do? Well, he had to address the reason why everybody was bowing to Baal. And those reasons, folks, were in their hearts. So he had to address that. He had to put it in their hearts. He had to create, like David prayed, a clean heart in them. That's the only way that any of us are preserved from doing wicked things, is the action of God, addressing the reasons why we're drawn to do those things. And this creation of a different heart was fundamental to the whole issue. So when he says, I have reserved to myself 7,000, he's actually saying, look, I've done to 7,000 people basically what I did to Saul of Tarsus. I met him face to face. I convinced him he was on the wrong path. I identified myself to him, and I overwhelmed him with my identity and the truthfulness of my stuff, and he believed me. He had to do that for these 7,000, or it wasn't going to fly. And that's why he says, it's the same way now. There's this remnant according to this activity of God. So, back there in the days of Elijah, the plan was to preserve a group of human beings who would be faithful to God, and the condition was the condition of the heart of man, the ability and willingness of human beings to trust in Yahweh. And Paul's argument is that this element, this issue of the large plan, and that this issue is the preservation of people so that they can participate with him in his plan. This issue is so close to the bottom of the pile of the plan. I mean, the plan has some fundamental bottom foundational things. The preservation of people so that they can participate in the plan of God for all eternity is right down here at the bottom, and the condition of people has never changed. So that's how Paul can say, okay, that's where it was then, and now it's the same way, because the situation is still the same. And what is the controlling issue in the whole process is God's decision to get involved with human beings, one-on-one. So, Paul is dealing with unchanging factors at the level of the bottom of the pile, and that's how he can argue that God's method is not ever going to change. As long as men are sinful, God's method of dealing with them and bringing them into a participation with him in eternal life is always going to have to be the same. He's going to have to choose to do it on their behalf. And fundamentally, that's the bottom line in the integrity of God, because people who want to throw up roadblocks to faith in God inevitably are going to have to come down to the issue of where does the faith that people have in whatever God they have come from? And who's responsible for it? And Paul's answer is, well, if you're talking about the kind of faith that actually changes a person's heart and gives him a relationship with God, then you're talking about something God has to do. Now, we don't mind that applying to us on the positive side. I don't mind being one of God's elect, if in fact I am. Peter said in 2 Peter, you have to make sure of your calling and election. But what really throws the switch for most people is the fact that God's making this choice, and there's a whole bunch of people that are not going to be chosen. Isn't that where the rubber hits the thing? Isn't that where everybody goes into this? Oh. Well, there isn't any way around that. In Romans 9, it says, I will have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll harden whom I harden. Say, well, is that unrighteous? Can't possibly be.
Righteousness is a justice issue. If you want God to be just, then you're going to have to batten down the hatches, because that means everybody's going to be cast into hell. That's justice. Say, well, but doesn't God have to be equally gracious to all? Well, why would we say that? You remember the parable of the guy that went out and hired some people early in the morning to go out and work in his field? And he agreed with them before he ever went that he'd pay them a denarius. And then about 9 o'clock that morning, it wasn't going to get done, so he went back into the labor pool and he hired some more guys and he said, I'll pay you what's right. And he sent them into the field, and they worked 3 hours less than those first guys. And then at noon, he went back. He says, they're not picking fast enough. We're not going to get this done. We need some more men. So he hired some, and they worked half a day. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he went back and hired some more because they needed to get it done, and they only worked 3 hours. And so he told his paymaster, he said, pay them all a denarius. So these guys that had worked 3 hours, they got up in the front of the line, and the guy handed them a denarius. And the guys at the back of the line said, oh, wow, they're getting a denarius for 3 hours, and we worked four times that long. We're going to get a lot of money. But as the line went past, everybody got a denarius. Well, that's so un-American. Where's the union? And so they started raising this big stink, and the guy said, now, wait a minute. When I hired you, I told you what I'd pay you. Didn't I? Yeah. You agreed to work for that, didn't you? Yes. Well, then take what you've earned and quit griping about whether I'm going to be generous with somebody else or not. It's none of your business. That doesn't fly very well in American economics, but that's what Jesus said his father was like. He can be gracious to whomever he chooses. Because grace isn't a justice issue. If he'd have denied them their denarius, that'd have been unjust. But he paid them what he owed them. If he'd have paid them four times what he owed them, that would have been grace. They didn't earn that. They earned one. So when it comes down to this whole issue of God's choice, there isn't any way we can reject that as not fair or unjust or whatever, because it's an election of grace, not justice. Okay. That probably opened a can of worms, but maybe not. We've been over this before. Do you have any comment or question that you want to raise? No brave soul. Okay, well, that's our word of prayer then. And we can visit with one another. Father, as we bow before you, we freely confess that we don't understand much about what you really like. When we consider the heavens, the works of your hands, and the magnitude of the creation, and then we look at the fact that you would consider saving us, human beings on planet Earth, in a universe that's so vast that we're nothing. So when we translate that reality into who you are and what you're like, we have to acknowledge we don't know you very well. But we don't want to be defeated in our pursuit of the knowledge of you by false arguments about whether your word is true. We know that you're going to take the steps that need to be taken to make sure that your word is fulfilled. And we're going to trust you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.